Hey, you. Yeah, you, man. Let me ask you something. You like making great money, right? All right. Well, here's a really cool opportunity that I just had to share with you. Driving with Uber. Yeah, Uber. That's right. That popular smartphone app that connects riders with drivers. Heard of it? I know you have. You're probably Ubering right now while you listen to the About Last Night podcast. Let me tell you something. I love Uber. I Uber all the time. I take it when I'm trying not to drink and drive. I take it when I'm trying to not waste gas. I take it when I'm just trying to make some new friends. You know why? Because Uber drivers, man, most of them got really interesting stories for why they even started getting involved with Uber in the first place. Let me tell you why Uber drivers love their job. They love being their own boss. They love earning great money. They love how you just need a license and a car to start. That's it, man. Driving with Uber is great for anyone who needs flexibility in their life. Parents, you know why you love Uber? Because it's a really easy way to work around your family's schedule. Students, you know why you love Uber? Because you can make some extra cash in between those classes. Now, the prime time to cash in driving with Uber is right now. Okay, you're going to thank me for telling you how to get paid every week. You got a car, you got a license, boom, put them both to work for you and start earning serious life-changing money today by signing up to Drive with Uber. Visit drivewithuber.com, that's drivewithuber.com, drivewithuber.com. Excuse me, I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. What's the name of that website one more time? I'll tell you, Tony Danza, it's drivewithuber.com. And now enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Hey everybody, it's Brad Williams for the About Last Night podcast. Thank you for downloading a brand new episode, and I know you're going to love this one because our guest is the extremely talented, extremely funny, extremely bald Maz Jobrani. Maz Jobrani is our guest today, a great comic, great guest. We've been trying to have him on the podcast forever, but he's a very busy guy, man. He's a working actor. If you look at his IMDb page, he's just been on everything. He's constantly touring, doing stand-up, not just in America. He tours the world, the world. He is truly a world traveler. Maz was born in Iran, and then he came to America, became a comedian, started the Axis of Evil comedy tour, which is just a revolutionary, really innovative idea where you got a bunch of Middle Eastern comics together after 9/11 and kind of were telling all us racist white people to be like, hey, we're not the enemy. We're not evil. This is our perspective. Adam and I had a great time talking to him. He made some fascinating points and really offered a new perspective on a lot of things that we haven't considered before. And then we had some goofy moments, as we always do. So this was really a fun one, and I know you're going to love it. So enjoy Maz Jobrani, but also please go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, rate the podcast, tell us why you like it. Leave a comment. You know, why do you like the podcast? Is it because I do really bad impressions? Like my Michael Caine. My Michael Caine is not really a good impression, but yeah, whatever. Do you like Adam's really good impressions? Do you like Danny Glover? Do you like how we get goofy with the guests? What do you like? Tell us what you enjoy about the podcast and rate us on iTunes. That helps us climb the charts and really lets us know that you're listening. Also, go to aboutlastnightpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner whenever you gotta do some shopping. Go to Amazon, shop like normal. You could buy Maz Jobrani's book. That's right, he wrote a book. He's a really intelligent dude. His book is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. It's great. Go to aboutlastnightpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner, pick up the book, read, get smarter. Maybe you can get smart like Maz one day. Also go to estoymerchandise.com. Adam and I have lots of great About Last Night podcast merchandise. We've got Roni and the Quave t-shirts. We've got About Last Night podcast mugs. We've got a t-shirt where I'm attached to Adam on a baby Bjorn riding on the head of the Titanic in a kind of a homoerotic situation, but it's not gay if it's a Jew or a dwarf. I think Danny Glover said that. Did he? I don't know. Whatever. Please continue to follow us on Twitter. Follow Adam on Twitter at Adam Ray Comedy. and go to AdamRayTV.com for all of his dates. Adam is going to be in New York August 14th at the Gramercy Theater. He's going to be opening up for Brent Morin when Brent records his Netflix special. So that's going to be awesome. Brent Morin, friend of the podcast. That's going to be a great show. Adam is also going to be at the Tropicana in Las Vegas doing the Laugh Factory August 31st through September 6th. Check him out there. Do some gambling. See a show. See some Cirque du Soleil stuff. See a bunch of guys in tights. Then go see my boy Adam at the Tropicana. He's also going to be at Hyenas in Fort Worth, Texas, September 17th. Through the 19th. So go check him out at Hyenas. Follow me on Twitter at FunnyBrad and come see me on tour, Marietta, California. I'm going to be at Aces Comedy Club August 7th and 8th. Come on out to those shows. Corpus Christi, Texas. That's right. I'm going to be in Corpus Christi, home of the two-story Whataburger. Yeah, there's a two-story fast food joint called Whataburger there. It's great. But I'm not going to be there. I'm going to be at Chuckles Comedy Club August 20th through the 22nd. So come out to Chuckles Comedy Club in Corpus Christi. See me. And also Virginia Beach, Virginia. I'm going to be at the Funny Bone August 27th through the 30th. So come out. See me and Adam do live stand-up. Keep listening to the podcast. Keep rating it on iTunes. Follow Maz Jobrani on Twitter at Maz Jobrani. Pick up his book. And I think that's everything. Those are the dates. That's the info. That's the info about the podcast. What do I say next? I'm not sure. This is Adam's gig. He usually does this, but he's off shooting a movie and a TV show. I'm kind of lonely right now. I don't know why I'm opening up to you in this moment. I should be getting louder and ending the podcast and ending the intro so we can get to it. All right, let's get to it. Rate us on iTunes. Subscribe to the podcast. Visit Amazon. Pick up everything, see us live, and now sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with our guest, Mr. Maz Jobrani.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to our dope podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. It's about last night.
And I had to fly the next day to Monaco for like this Persian New Year event.
Yeah.
And this lady had booked me like a year in advance, and she was so excited about the whole thing. She was like, she kept calling me like, everything's like as is, right? We're ready to go. Like, no problems. I was like, no, it's all good. It's just all year. I'm like, relax. It's gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And then I go to Sweden, 4 or 5 days in Sweden. Like the last day in Sweden, the night of my show, my voice starts going, and I think I got sick and something else. Like you were saying, it just starts going.
Oh,
and I was like, oh shit! And then,
panic, so, for sure.
Yeah, the night, because this is the night before the event. This is at my special. Ah, yes, it was at my special. And it was the night before this Monaco thing, and I was like, oh my god! So then I there was a girl that was at the show who was opening for me, and she used to sing and stuff. So she was like, listen, I got these lozenges, and you could take it.
It's always a lozenge.
Yeah, and it's got like a steroid in it or something.
Yeah.
She's like, use it when you have to.
Was it just a Sucret, or was it some sort of weird Swedish?
Some sort of weird Swedish shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was crazy. So then,
but you had to do it. At that point, when you can feel it, when you're that desperate, you're just like, I'll do anything. It could have been a lozenge. It could have been, she'd be like, look, there's this homeless guy, you got to jerk off real quick.
Oh,
and then
yeah,
you got like his cum has like this lozenge. We don't have lozenges because now we use bum cum.
Yeah,
and it, like,
yeah, yeah.
The
exactly.
Bum cum.
That's actually the name of the comb.
I think I saw that late night infomercial.
Yeah,
two weeks ago. It's like, yeah,
is your voice going out?
Yeah.
Can't get that hit that high C anymore.
And then it just shows Boon Shakalaka on the corner, like, I'll help you out.
Yeah. How dare you? By the way, terrible Boon Shakalaka.
That's a horrible Boon Shakalaka impression.
Is that what he sounds like? No,
it's not how it sounds.
Boon's much more high. It's a black. Like this, it's like, what's 12 inches in white? Not a damn thing.
Love that guy. Boon Shakalaka.
Are we recording? We're recording.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we're going right
Wait,
now.
Wait, so I want to ask you about that too, doing a special in Sweden. At what point did you, I was just talking to somebody else about doing comedy overseas, and I was like, when did you realize you had like a following over there? Or were you just like, oh, fuck it, I want to do it there?
Yeah. No, what happened was, first of all, the Scandinavian countries are big comedy fans. And it's like relatively young there, but they're huge fans. Like everybody, anytime I go there, people touring me are like, yeah, did you know, like,
yeah, I think Burr did a tour over there.
Burr,
Whitney,
yeah, Louis Black, yeah, Louis C.K., Charlie Murphy, all these guys. Everybody goes through.
Wow,
and they're big comedy fans. And and for me, what happened was after Access to Evil came out, I know that there's a lot of Iranians in Sweden, and the reason is because Sweden has a very open immigration policy, so a lot of Iranians had immigrated there. So I was like, okay, well, there's Iranians there.
They love comedy, and
the Swedes love comedy.
Yeah,
and also I know that we had sold. I think the Access to Evil special aired in Scandinavia, either Sweden or Norway. I forget which one. Mm-hmm. But I was like, hey, there's potential there. So I went to Stockholm. Stockholm to me is one of my favorite places to perform in the world.
Like, why?
They're amazing. They're very. It's just a very international crowd. It's very cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
The last time I was there was last, actually I was there this March as well. But before that, when I was there in May of 2014, there's a theater called the China Theater. And I don't know what it is, the acoustics or something. Man, I told them, I said, this is probably one of my three best shows I've ever done. Cause it was just like everything was hitting.
Yeah.
They got every joke. That's one of the things of doing stand-up in Europe, too, I think, compared to just in the U.S., is that they understand, I think they know more about international stuff than an American audience would.
Mm-hmm.
But America, don't get me wrong, some American audiences are great as well. But so Sweden was amazing, and you go out there and you do, like last time I was out there, I did a crazy tour because you do Stockholm, which is rock and roll, right? It's a theater, all this stuff. Then they were like, we're going to throw in... I forget what it was. Like, there was a place called Bergen. I think Bergen was in Norway. I don't know. Whoever's listening could probably look it up.
Something with a lot of consonants.
Yeah.
Bergen.
Bergen.
Not to be confused with Candace Bergen. Not again. Murphy Brown.
Exactly. Wait, they didn't name the town after her?
Yeah.
I mean, they've named
they
something.
They should have.
They named the bum cum lozenge after her.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But no, but what was the Bergen? But, so you end up in some cities where you're like, oh, there's only like, you know, 80 people here, like what, you know,
yeah.
so you may as well be doing a club because I'm not, it's not like I'm nationally known over there, mm-hmm. but in the major cities they come out.
But did you have to do a ton of promoting for it, or were they just like, oh cool, a comic we haven't seen before that's coming over here?
No, I think most of the people that came to my shows are probably fans, and then sometimes this was interesting.
You have a following at this point, right?
Like I got a small following, like in the major
cities. Yeah, but you have a following.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You pack out places because of it.
Yeah, well listen, if you, first of all, if you have a
don't
clips
raise your
online.
Voice at me.
Hey, listen, my voice can work. No, if you have if you have some like your clips online, like I know like Gabriel Iglesias is huge, Pablo
right.
Francisco, because their clips have just circulated.
Burr
there.
And Russell blew up from clips, right?
Yeah, clips sure. will help a lot. So those clips help you over there a lot. They come out, they want to laugh. The interesting thing to me was my very last show, because I did 12. Cities in 14 nights. So I was like flying, driving, flying. And it was Holland.
Yeah.
So it was Holland. It was Belgium.
Named after Mr. Holland's Opus.
Holland's Opus,
obviously.
Of course. Belgium, named after the beer. and then it was Norway, Sweden, and I think that was it. Was that it?
Jesus.
So, but the last show was in Trondheim, which is in the northern part of Norway.
Yeah.
And it's this beautiful, just pristine city. And you forget, like, it was May, so it was like 11 o'clock and it was bright out. But it was beautiful. Just a beautiful city.
Yeah, the time difference.
Yeah.
Whoa, don't say that like you know anything about it.
Well, no, because I've heard, I haven't been over there, but I like there's a bunch of comics that have been over there, and I think it's kind of the same thing when I've done shows in Alaska where, it's 11 p.m.
Because it's north.
And, it's so far north that it's bright outside.
Does that throw you off, or are you...
It kind of excited me. Unfortunately, I was so tired, and I wasn't there with, like, I was every town I would go to, they would just bring, like, a local opener. So I wasn't there with like a buddy or like with my wife or something that we could be like, let's go check out the nightlife. It was just like I was exhausted. So I was like, oh, this is cool. And you just look out your window and you're like, what a beautiful, like there was mountains and stuff. But here's what's crazy.
I'm assuming their nightlife is pretty crazy over there too.
I'm sure the nightlife is crazy. I mean, it's just like
the Swedish clubs have got to be all sorts of fucking, there's probably
just filled with beautiful people.
Beautiful people. And there's probably one that they just like, they've got like a bunch of like holograms of like the Swedish chef, like from the Muppets. Just like fucking so fucking like, weird, like weird Swedish girls, like
yeah,
Muppet
so
style.
Like you, it's, yeah. Like, it's like you walk in and it's just a chef going,
yeah, for sure.
And
but you're just like, a really wow. crazy beat.
Yeah, yeah. This giving is out fantastic. Energy.
He's the DJ. It's amazing. but no, but so this was interesting to me because I woke up that was my last city on the tour. Wake up at 6 in the morning. I get in my cab, and there's a Norwegian guy. By the way, the Norwegians are the cab drivers. It's not like, it's not Middle Eastern dudes, not Mexicans.
They didn't bring in a minority from somewhere else?
No minority. The Norwegian was driving.
How are they doing
this? So instead of like Hagbar, it was like Bjorn?
Bjorn. And Bjorn is amazing because I think they make like a decent living over there because all the other stuff's paid for, like healthcare and all this other stuff. So, but it was interesting because I got in there and he was like reading a paper at 6 in the morning, and then he looks at me and he's like, oh, I heard you, I read about you. You had a good show last night. And I'm like, you read about me? There was a good show. It was literally the night before. Wow. And he's like, yeah, right here. And then like I looked at it, and there was a review from my show in the local paper that like someone had come and reviewed it, and they give
within
you
5 hours?
Within 5 hours. And then they give you, you know, a dice has, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 6. So 6 is the best. So I got 6 on the dice.
Hey!
And the guy was like, you got a 6. I was like, really? I was like, I got 6, baby.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So, that's good in Monopoly and in reviews for comedy shows.
And in Trondheim.
Yeah, and in Trondheim.
Not since Bjorn Borg won Wimbledon had anyone gotten a 6.
Yeah, I did.
That's the only Swedish name I could pull out.
Yeah, that's great.
And I don't even think he's Swedish.
But I was in Norway. No, Bjorn Borg is Swedish.
Is he?
Bjorn Borg is Swedish.
Woo!
Bjorn Borg, I have a story about Bjorn Borg.
How do you have a Bjorn Borg story?
Dude, I got stories. My Bjorn Borg story turned into it turned into a joke because what happened was, again, I'm on this tour where it's every night different city.
Yeah.
I don't have time to do laundry.
Nope.
So by day 10 or 11.
Bjorn Borg does, though.
Bjorn Borg does.
Is that where the story's going?
Exactly. No, I'm at the airport, and I'm like, dude, I got to buy some underwear. So I go to this little shop. I look over. Now, as a kid, when I first moved to America in the late 70s, born in Iran, moved to America late 70s.
Keep listening, people. Keep listening. Just said he's born from Iran. It's okay.
We just got the nuclear deal today.
Today?
Yeah.
A few hours ago.
Good things are happening. Yeah. Iran and the U.S. Nuclear deal, baby. Nuclear deal.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cuba and Iran, 1 year.
Look at that.
Let's do it. Next spring break. Listen, what I'm saying is, I was a huge fan because when I moved to America in the late 70s, Borg was the shit. It was Borg like and McEnroe. And it was amazing.
You a big tennis guy?
I became like for a minute. Yeah. I became really big, and I bought the Donne racket. He had the Donne racket. I had the Fila sweatsuit. I wanted to be like Borg.
Please tell me you had the hair.
I did not have the hair. I had hair, but not that
the
hair.
The big blonde
I
mullet.
I wish. Oh, God.
Oh my God.
If my parents would have let me. So then, you know, then I hadn't heard about him in a long time, and I'm a big fan, and I was like, whatever happened? And like, you know, you read about like your heroes, and I'd read like he had some like financial problems and this and that. So I'm in Sweden, I'm in Stockholm, one of those airports, and I go to buy underwear, and there's Borg underwear. He's got a line of. I was like, wait a minute, is that the Borg? And the guy was like, yeah. I'm like, holy shit! I'm like, I'm buying that. I bought a bunch of Borg underwear. It was amazing. And then the joke I do, I said, now I recommend it to everybody. I go, because ever since I bought the Borg underwear, and now when I walk down the street, my balls just play tennis with each other. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's fantastic.
I love that I pulled out a random Bjorn Borg reference.
And he had a story in the chamber.
Of course I have a Bjorn Borg story.
Listen to this. Here's what's crazy.
But when you travel, look at our jobs, man. When you travel, we're all going to continue to accumulate stories like that. And that's only because of what we do.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why it's the fucking best.
It's the best. It's the best. And here's what's crazy is because we assume that everybody else is kind of in the same realm, but they're not. And so what happened, like in Sweden, I did the Borg story. I did the Borg joke. Place blew up because they know who Borg is. It's like saying Michael Jordan over there.
Right, yeah.
I started doing it here in America, and people. A couple nights, it was like lukewarm response. And I look out in the audience, I realized some of these guys are too young to know who Borg is.
Yeah, they have no idea.
And I was like, do you guys know who Borg is? And the guy was like, uh-uh. And I was like, what?
You got to say Serena Williams.
Serena Williams are turning around. I changed it to Rafael Nadal underwear, and they still didn't know who that was.
Oh, Jesus. What can a guy do?
You know, I mean, I guess you just got to go with Federer because he's got a Gillette commercial.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Or I got to be like, you know, I got, you know, did you know LeBron James has underwear? I bought a pair. Now my balls are just dunking all the time.
Yeah.
Dunking my balls.
They're throwing bounce passes with my testicles, which I'm sure might have been the ad campaign.
Exactly. My balls are shooting three-pointers, whatever.
That's insane that, I mean, first of all, it's so great that you're getting to go to all these different places, and you are truly an international comedian. You really are, because you go everywhere.
I try. You know what I tell people? I say that, like, I think comedy has opened up for all of us, and I think especially if you listen, if you, but part of it is you pick up stuff as you go to these places.
Absolutely.
So if you go to a place like, you know, wherever, if you go to a place like Scandinavia and you get jokes about there, and then you end up in the Middle East and you do jokes about Scandinavia, they still are with you because they're like, oh, he's talking about there, and now he's going to talk about here, and now he's going to talk about, you know.
Yeah.
So there's something to that. But I also think that because of the internet, the world is a lot smaller. I think back, like, you know, in the 80s, people would be like, yeah, you know, I'm doing the Cleveland ha-ha and the whatever and whatever.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
it.
And that's it.
Now, like, when I go to the Middle East, when I was in the Middle East last, they were like, yeah, Chris Tucker was recently here. The Wayans brothers were there.
In the Middle East?
In the Middle East. Eddie Griffin. When I did Saudi Arabia, they were like, yeah, we had Eddie Griffin. I go, how did... And they go... Because they told me, they go, work clean. And I was like, how did Eddie Griffin work clean?
Yeah, exactly.
In
He's not
Saudi
exactly,
Arabia.
Well, because we all know that you can show undercover brother to children. Like,
yeah,
it's,
yeah, yeah. But it's like, you know, but I guess what he did, they were telling me, was like, he did 45 minutes clean.
Yeah.
And then towards the end, he was like, they told me to keep it clean. You guys want it to go clean? And what's crazy in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh, they're doing now public shows. Because in the past, the guy promoting it was more like an underground thing. So he would do it in like... private places, so like they would have a mixed crowd. Now in the public places, like to your left is all guys and to your right are families.
What?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I suppose like when Eddie Griffin was like, would you guys like me to, you know, should I keep going clean? The guy, all the people on the left, the guys were like, no, we want you to cuss.
Yeah.
So he started cussing the last 15 minutes.
And then, and then the families are just like, this is horrible.
And the families, yeah. And I experienced that because I was there and I would do a penis joke and the left side would laugh.
Yeah.
And the right side would look shocked. And then I would do like a joke about my kids and the right side would laugh and the left side would stare at me like, kids? We're all kids.
What happened, man? Why the separation? Do you know?
Well, that's how it is. So they're not supposed to have, like, in Saudi Arabia is one of the more strict countries in that sense. So, like, the men and women sit separately. Restaurants, if you go to a restaurant, there is, like, there's a men's section and then there's a family section. So yeah. Women aren't supposed to be out in public. Women can't drive in Saudi Arabia. So they have drivers. So this was interesting. I was in Riyadh one night. We did a show. Riyadh
is in what country?
Saudi Arabia. That's the capital of Saudi Arabia.
Okay, just trying to follow.
So we do. I was in Riyadh one night, and the locals.
Brad's knowledge of the world is, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego reruns?
Yeah.
I've learned a lot from that.
So have I.
I mean, all I've pretty much learned is that a red trench coat goes in any country.
Yeah. There you go.
That's a Carmen Sandiego joke. If you don't know about that, then that joke is very confusing.
You couldn't do that in Saudi Arabia.
I don't even get it, but that's fine.
Listen, that's all right.
Riyadh is east of Rosemead. You just got to keep going. You just go on the 10. Just keep going east.
Okay.
Just keep going east.
Where is it in relation to Glendale?
Yeah. It's just kind of southeast.
Southeast. Okay. Southeast of Glendale. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I got it.
No, but so one night we did a show, and then they're like, "Hey, let's go eat somewhere." Like, great. And it's like, now it's like 1 a.m. on a Saturday, whatever it was, Friday, whatever it was, their night off. Because their weekend's different than our weekend as well. Like, their Friday is their Saturday, and whatever. Their weekend starts Thursday.
Gotcha.
Anyway, so we're driving and we go to this strip, and it's packed, cars packed, people walking around, music's blaring. I'm like, this place is happening.
Oh, yeah.
And then I look around, I was like, wait a minute. Holy shit, it's all dudes. It was all dudes because the girls can't be out. And so, like, I was asking the guy, I was like, are there any girls on this? And he goes, sometimes, like, some of the, like, girls will get their drivers to bring them into this thing. And, like, as they're driving past another guy, like, they'll, like, throw their number at them, or, like, they'll exchange, like, text or whatever. That kind of stuff goes down. But for the most part, they can't do that. And then you look out the cafes, and all the cafes, just a bunch of dudes sitting around. And the guy was like, you know what sucks? And it was hot. It was hot as hell. And the guy's like, you know what sucks? He goes, I can't even go sit out there with my wife right now. Like, they wouldn't let me do that. So they're segregated like that, and it's the trippiest thing. Like, last time I was at in Saudi Arabia, I went to go to a restaurant with these, you know, the promoters,
yeah.
And they're a couple guys, and we start going in, and the guy at the door is like, oh, no, he's like, you know, single section is on the other side. Mm-hmm. So I was like, single means like a guy, like you're not there with your family.
Right.
You could be married, but you're still considered single because you're there with other dudes. And then I made it a joke as well. I was on stage. I was like, I was like, yeah, when I went there, the guy was like, single, single. I was like, yeah, okay, we'll go. I'll go sit with the single people. Let's see what's up. And then I go sit down. I look around. It's a bunch of single dudes. I was like, no, not gay single. Mixed single.
Yeah.
Wow. But it's a trip. It is a trip.
Brad and I are going to India for the first time through Raj Sharma next January.
Yeah.
Any just quick tips?
I've never done India.
Oh,
but
really?
I'm sure that India is like, I've heard that the Indians are like big comedy fans. And I'm sure, you know, listen, first of all, I think anytime you go as an outsider and you talk about them for the first 5-10 minutes and your experiences, mm-hmm. like you don't want to just go right on stage and be like, whatever.
So, Glendale.
Yeah, what about
funny.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right?
Well, the I-5 traffic. It's yeah. right. I go to the OC, Orange yeah. County. You guys
yeah.
know.
So, yeah. Do not go there. Like, you want to go up there and be like, holy shit, like, you guys, and be complimentary at first. Like, you know, this is beautiful, this, that, and the other. And, like, but we have to pull over for a cow and whatever experience
yes, yeah.
you have.
I totally agree. And I adapted that mentality. I'd say maybe the second year into my, only been headlining for 3 years, but like the second year where I was like, oh, I need to. Like it made me more comfortable to, you know, shoot the shit in some way when I got on stage and not go right into my act. But I found like, oh, this is why I need to like go out and do some stuff while I'm here in the city, even if it is fucking Toledo, Ohio, or whatever, just to have something organic and like relatable to talk about right off the bat.
Yeah,
that can make them go, oh, cool, because I feel like the audience gets off on you on knowing like, oh, cool, he didn't just like, he's not coming in and coming out. He actually came in and he's like, this is where we live, and he like. Got to experience some
yeah,
of
it. Yeah, it's that outsider perspective.
Yeah, I think Richard Pryor had a special that he did in New Orleans, and he does that. Like the first 5 minutes is just him mm-hmm. talking about his experience.
Have you always done that, or did you somebody kind of tell
I think
you
that to... was the light bulb. I think that was seeing him. I was like, ah. And then when I traveled overseas, it was impossible not to do it because you had such crazy experiences. Like you'll see the driving is crazy. There's like no lanes. There's donkeys crossing streets. There's like old ladies, you know, carrying 300 pounds of, you know, produce, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's like you and they love it. They're proud of it. And it gives you like a good, some places you can get like 10, 15 minutes just right off the bat of just doing, talking about being there.
Cause like I've been to the Middle East to do USO tours, but you're on bases. You're not like going out like other than maybe countries like Bahrain.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't let us go out cause they're like, cause if some shit happens to you, you have like one Marine who's like your guide, like they can't stop things from going on.
Yeah.
Like they I was told some crazy stories where we had like a female Marine guide, and that was a trip to all the locals there.
Sure.
And men would try to take a picture with her because they said like, well, the only person you could take a picture with is your wife. So if you like take a picture with her, it's like the guy would be like, okay, now we're married.
No.
That's what she told me.
What? No.
That's what she told me.
If he got a picture with her, then that means they're officially married?
That's what he was trying to tell her. Like, okay, we're married now.
I can't believe that. I mean, I doubt that. I mean, maybe to an extent, that's what the guy thought. Like, maybe like, but I know what you're saying. It's like, it is a trip in some of these places because like exactly what I just said, like mm-hmm. some things that you and I wouldn't believe, like the fact that women can't drive in some places is pretty mind boggling.
Is just amazing. I mean, horrible. Yeah, terrible.
Yeah,
I mean.
But no, but it is interesting. Like that's what it is. That's what the cultural difference is. If you are able to, talk about that, from an outsider's point of view, like I said, like Lebanon, I went to Lebanon, Beirut. Like they're proud of the fact that they've had all this turmoil and yet they continue to celebrate life and they party. So it's like mm-hmm. that was big on their thing. So I kept saying like, you guys party out here, and they're like,
we fire missiles into countries, but whatever.
Yeah, once in a while you got to do it, man.
Well, you're good. Like in your. Your career is so amazing to me because with the Axis of Evil comedy tour, and that was the original tour was you, Ahmed, who else?
Yeah, originally it was called the Arabian Nights, and that started in 2000 where Mitzi Shore put the Arabian Nights together. It was her idea.
Oh, wow.
And she'd been watching the news, and it was the latest uprising between the Palestinians and the Israelis. There was fighting, and she's like, I think there's going to be a need for positive voice for Middle Easterners in the near future.
Wow.
Before September 11th.
Yeah. Holy shit. Yeah. Good call, Mitzi.
Yeah, exactly. So she put us together called the Arabian Nights, and it was me, Ahmed, Aaron Cater, Sam Tripoli, anybody who was brown that wasn't Mexican or black was on our show. So there was a guy named Anand Chulani who was an Indian guy that she found unaware. There was like a couple people did like she had some girls that were on there that would pretend to be belly dancers. There were white girls that were trying to belly. Yeah. It was crazy.
Mario Lopez, Enrique Iglesias,
all those guys. Yeah, it was crazy. It was
all
a crazy,
the brown, not black guys.
Yeah. It was a very weird show, and I was like, and my thought at then, like I kind of didn't have faith. I remember being on the phone with Ahmed Ahmed and going like, okay, we could do this once, but I was like, who's going to keep coming back? Because we didn't have that many comedians that were from that part of the world at that point. So I was like, if they keep coming back to the same show, that's it.
Yeah,
like,
keep changing
like,
our material.
Yeah, you can do black comedy night because there's so many black comedians. Yeah.
Right.
But I go, we're it. There's no more. And then eventually what happened was all the others kind of fell off and it became me, Ahmed, Aaron, and Sam Tripoli. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Ahmed got us to go do some shows in D.C. at the D.C. Improv. And then it just became me, Aaron, and Ahmed. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing. And then eventually that then turned into the Axis of Evil comedy tour, and we brought on Dino Bidala.
Yeah, and then 9/11 happened.
Then 9/11 happened, yeah.
But before that, the tour, so once it really got going, though, I mean, it was, that helped really establish all you guys. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, it wasn't just the tour. It was, because the tour, listen, man, you can do so much. I mean, listen, after 9/11, we got a lot of press because people were curious. They were like, who are these Muslim comedians doing
that we've accepted
right. that are doing stand-up, and in all honesty, like even though I come from a Muslim background and country, I don't really consider myself that religious, but I was doing material that dealt with the issue, because it was interesting, because I felt very American. Mm-hmm. But I felt like it was a double whammy, because these guys had attacked my country of America,
right,
and then the Bush administration felt like it was attacking my people that were not the Iraqis, but just Middle Easterners in general,
right.
You know? And also just in general, as a human being,
yeah,
I felt
so
like the war with Iraq.
Torn, because you're like, wow, I'm mad at, not like,
no,
I'm
I wasn't
mad,
torn. It was very clear. It was very clear that in my opinion, the Bush administration had manipulated what had happened to their advantage and gotten into the wrong country. I really felt going into Iraq and starting a war was wrong.
Mm-hmm. 1,000%.
Yeah. You know, and so that's how I felt that before all the facts came out, and I feel that now. And I think a lot of people now also go, oh, yeah, maybe we're wrong. But some people still argue that it was right. But I,
sure.
You know, because people, it's so funny in America. That's what upsets me sometimes is when we accept like a phrase, you know, they go like, you know, they did it because they hate our freedoms. They flew the planes into our buildings because they hate our freedoms. No, dumbass. That's not why they did it. It's a deeper issue. There's a political issue. We have a military in Saudi Arabia. These guys, what their act that they did was not right, flying the planes into the building. Yeah. But what they're saying, if you reverse it and you put it on you, and they're saying, look, why does America have a presence in Saudi Arabia, a military base in Saudi Arabia, and they're saying that the Saudi leadership is corrupt, and so they're saying, therefore, we want to fight against the Saudi leadership and against America. So you sit there and you go, oh, I understand the argument. I'm not saying I support the argument. Right. I'm not saying that I would ever support.
Let's make that clear.
Yeah, I'm never.
Samad Jabrani isn't saying it's a good thing.
But that's what I'm saying. So whenever you say like things like, oh, you know, the war with Iraq was wrong, people go, well, so you like Saddam Hussein? No, I didn't like Saddam Hussein. Was bad. He was a dictator. Yeah. But look at the results of what we have now. We never hear the number of how many Iraqis have been killed. We never get that number. We get the American troops, 3,000-4,000 maybe. I'm not sure exactly where we're at now. But Iraqis, I've talked to journalists, American journalists who've covered it, and they're saying it's well over 100,000 easy.
Wow.
And so you sit there and you're like, oh wow. And then you think about it strategically and you go, wait a minute, we were saying that one of our bigger enemies in the region is Iran, but Iraq itself is a Shiite majority, but it was being led by Sunnis. So as soon as we got rid of the Sunni leader, that's when the Shiites come in and they want control, and then that's when the Sunnis, who are a minority, then they start forming ISIS, and now we've got, you know, we've kind of created, if you think about it, strategically speaking, if you go back to what those 19 hijackers did, we played right into their hands, because we basically fought their war for them. Because we said, here you go, we'll go ahead and get rid of Saddam. Because when Saddam was there, you wouldn't have had this kind of terrorism happening, because they would have clamped down on it. But and again, I'm not supporting Saddam. I'm just saying.
Right.
So my the point.
It's more of just the law of unintended cause and effect.
Like, no, it's the more the issue that the Bush administration either knew what they were doing,
right,
and they felt fine about it, because if you look at it in the bigger picture, when you find out companies like Halliburton and some of these other bigger companies made a ton of money out of it, mm-hmm. you go, oh, well, this starts making some sense. Or you think about the like a great documentary to see is Why We Fight. It's all about like the military industrial complex, and it talks about you know, there's weapons manufacturers, and these guys are making weapons. And if we don't sell or buy those or use those weapons, they're just going to sit there.
Yeah.
So war is good for business.
Yes.
So
movie, Lord of War with
yeah, the, exactly. Yeah, and you think about, and the other thing you think about is like you know I read some statistic or something that said like once after September 11th. Arms sales, like, I don't know, quadrupled or quintupled or whatever. It just went a lot higher, and we're the number one arms dealers. So what I'm trying to say is that I think that gave us a lot of material, because at first, after September 11th, I was like, this is bullshit. We need to attack the terrorists. Go get them, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But as soon as Bush came out and was like, all right, so now we're going to go and attack Iraq, I was like, wait a minute. You're tying the terrorists to Iraq. But really, you're sidestepping what we were supposed to do. Like after September 11th happened, there was a candlelight vigil held in Tehran, the capital of Iran,
yeah.
In honor of the victims, like kind of telling the Americans, look, we're with you.
Yeah, hey.
But that didn't get that much press. What got press was was that group of like whatever it was, Palestinians or whatever they were, that were jumping up and down, celebrating, throwing candy in the air.
Yeah,
and if you would have just turned the camera a little bit to the right, there's probably normal people just leading their lives, but there's only like 20 people celebrating. But then all Americans, man. Americans go, see, they're all celebrating.
Yeah. Propaganda.
And that's got to be increasingly frustrating for you, because you're sitting there going like, no, we don't want that kind of stuff to happen.
What frustrates me is then that makes me go, oh, wait a minute, my comedy, I do have a purpose here with this comedy now, with the Axis of Evil tour, which is to really go out and make fun of this.
Right.
Make fun of what Bush is doing. Make fun of the perception. Make fun of the fact that there's idiots out there that are going around shooting Indian Sikhs who have nothing to do with anything.
Yeah.
Even if you found a Muslim with a turban, you don't just go out and shoot him, you fucking idiot.
Right.
Right? That guy had nothing to do with it. You know, he's just leading his life. But you're an idiot, so you're going to go do this. So I realized, wait a minute, our comedy has a purpose here. And so what happened was, so after after September 11th, we start getting some press. And we get some, you know, you get some traction with your career as well. But I mean, I started stand up at 98, so I'm like three years into it at that point.
Shit.
So, but what happens is, as you go like to 2005 and 2006, 2007, now we're getting better and better. Our comedy's getting stronger. Our tour is getting stronger. We're starting to get more and more visibility. And that's when it came together. And really, what I think helped all of us a lot was when the special came out on Comedy Central. And when it came out on Comedy Central, we got a lot of press. We got a lot of people seeing us that normally wouldn't see us. We got letters from people like from South Carolina going like, my husband's in the military and I'm happy you guys are doing this, because there were people in the military. You know, we underestimate the people in the military. They're smarter than we give them credit for. And they're not all on the side of like, let's kill them Arabs. Some of them are like, hey, why are we at this fight? There was that, and then the other thing that really helped was that's when YouTube was really starting to take off. So then I would get these clips of my own clips. Remember back then, it was before, like, you wouldn't put your clip on Facebook, because Facebook wasn't around yet.
Yeah, right.
So what would happen is somebody would have a big-ass email list, and the clip would be in the middle.
Yeah,
and that would kept getting that from different people.
Yeah, it was weird cat videos or women getting hit by trains.
Yeah,
or, I got fucked up friends, but
or Maz Gibrani doing comedy,
or Two Girls One Cup, or Maz Gibrani.
There you go. Yeah.
So. Wait. So what was the clip that?
There was one that I did. I did a joke about how Iranians don't say we're Iranians, but say we're Persian, and because it sounds nicer and friendlier. And we'll be like, I'm Persian. I'm like the cat. Meow. And that became the thing. And it started circulating. Geez. And then everywhere I'd go, people were like, hey, Maz Gibrani, Persian cat, meow. And I was holy shit, this is kind
of
happening.
So was that your first taste of some celebrity fandom with people mimicking bits back to you?
Yeah, it was interesting. What was interesting was I did the movie Friday After Next, which was the Ice Cube movie. Yeah. It was the third Ice Cube movie. And so when that came out, that was, I think that had a big black and Latino fan base.
Absolutely.
So I would get recognized like
and Jewish. People forget. People forget.
Yes.
They showed at my temple when I was 9.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. It was big. It was hey.
I stick up for my people, but we really didn't like the Friday movies. I'm sorry.
Really?
I have no idea. I loved them.
No, it was a fun movie, but it wasn't like a critically acclaimed movie. It was like a fun, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had gotten people recognizing me from that before Axis of Evil, but they would recognize the character. The character I played was Molly. Mm-hmm. So I'd be walking down the street, people like, hey, what's up, Molly? Hey, it's Molly. Yo, it's Molly, man. And I was like, oh, that's cool. People know his Molly. But after Axis of Evil, people started knowing my name, which was great because then you go, oh, okay, now my brand is getting out there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a difference between people meowing at you like a Persian cat and then like actually kind of having some name to tie, associate you with.
Yeah, well, no, the Persian cat actually helped my name become, like, they're like, Maz Jobrani, Persian cat.
Okay,
meow.
Cool. Oh,
yeah,
nice.
Before that, it was, yo, it's Molly from Friday After Next.
Got
you know?
It, okay.
So yeah. It's like if you did Batman, people are like, it's Batman. But then, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I get Wee Man from Jackass, and that wasn't even me. So, fantastic.
There you have it, man.
I mean, but like, how is it for you when you sort of, because you sort of became a comedic voice for an entire people that isn't entirely represented. Like, if you look at the history of comedy, there's not a lot of Middle Eastern comedians.
Yeah.
So, like, you guys, like, do you feel some sort of added responsibility?
No, it's funny. I wrote a book, by the way. My book is called I'm Not a Terrorist, but I play one on TV.
Yes.
Buy it at Amazon.com.
Available on Amazon.com. You can go to aboutlastnightpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner, and then go buy Maz's book.
I'm Not a Terrorist, but I've played one on TV.
Yes.
So it's my biography. I write it, and I wrote it, you know, tried to be funny with it. And part of it I talk about. I talk about, like, I remember we were in Denver doing shows. And it was at the Democratic convention in 2008.
Right. Yeah.
So they'd gotten like a little club or something on the side, and there was like it was sponsored by the Arab American Institute, and there was just a mixed crowd or whatever.
What does Hillary smell like?
Hillary's delicious. None of those people were there. Oh, it was just like, you know, it was just regular audience.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so it was we did two shows. So the first show we did, it was fun. Then we had some drinks, and so I was kind of loose on the second show. Did the second show, and then I got an email from some guy going like, "Hey man, I was at your shows the other night, and you know I'm really upset because you were clearly on drugs." And I was like, "What?" And the guy kept insisting that I was on drugs. I was like, "No, dude, I don't do drugs. Like, I mean, I've done ecstasy in the past. I've smoked weed, but that's it. And I don't do it that often. So it's like,
and I also wasn't on drugs.
Yeah,
I wasn't. So
on
you're
drugs.
Wrong.
Yeah, so you're wrong." And then he was kind of insistent on it, and I go, listen, you know, I did have some tequila that night, so maybe I was kind of, you were maybe hearing some, and he was telling me, he's like, you should be ashamed because you are
role model.
Yeah. You're a role model for our community and for the younger people, and da da da. And I was like, what are you talking about? Anyway, we went back and forth, and then it turned out the guy's like, you know, I used to work in police, like drug enforcement or something, and I thought that was the case, and I basically we ended up like he ended up become he was a nice guy in the end,
yeah,
and he realized what I was saying, but then I realized that people might be throwing this role model label at me, but I was like, I don't want to be a role model. I was like, I will do. I'm
Charles Barkley, Maz Jobrani, same thing. No, I'm not a role model.
You're right though, man, because it's not why you're doing it.
Not at all why I'm doing it. And a lot of people would like sit there and they go, you know, like you're doing this material, that material, you're representing your people. I go, no, listen, first of all, my number one hope and goal is to be funny. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're going to do a joke about Bjorn Borg and my balls playing tennis. You know what I'm saying? And I find that
laughing
funny.
Laughing again. Yeah. Like if you just said that every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's funny to me. So it's not always going to. And nowadays, like with my kids, I do a lot more material about kids now than I do about any kind of political stuff.
And you feel like, too, if you are a role model, I feel like there's an extra. I feel like if you're so in the limelight and you have the role model thing slapped on you, you can't totally be yourself. Right?
Not at
especially
all.
Publicly.
Not
so either. What are you being a comic for if you can't speak your mind?
Absolutely.
So to say a comedian is a role model, I mean, you know, I mean,
it's like we get it, and because you're the voice of a people that didn't have a voice, but at the same time, that can't be your number one thought is how is this joke going to represent Middle Eastern people, Muslim religion,
yeah,
et cetera. Your first thought as a comedian always has to be, is it funny?
What's my point of view?
Yeah.
What's my point of view? What do I want to talk about? I'm not a jukebox. I'm not going to take requests. I've done, when I was doing, I think like maybe it was like my second tour or something, like I was doing more material about my kids and stuff, and I remember it was in Boston, and some lady came up afterwards. She's like, you know, you should do more jokes about Persians. And I was like, thank you. But that's it. Like, I'm not going to listen to you because, first of all, my audiences are mixed. There's absolutely all kinds of different people there. Secondly, my life now is what it is. And sometimes that comes back to bite you. Like, I was recently doing a show again in Beirut at American University of Beirut. So they're younger. It's a college crowd. Mm-hmm. And I got into my, after I did my 10 or 15 minutes of like local stuff, I got into my family stuff and I kind of lost them.
I was going to say how. Yeah.
They're too young. They didn't get it.
I did a college once and for the first time started doing material about my nieces, 5-year-old twin girls. They were just like, not into it, because like, hey man, we don't have that yet.
Yeah.
And then I started making jokes about like, oh, you guys don't have kids? Well, some of you probably do, you just don't know yet. And then that got an awkward silence because I was just making a joke about them,
right?
You know, like, unprotected sex.
Yeah, teenage pregnancy. They're like, oh, we do, but we don't really want to talk about that. Can you go back to making jokes about the Thundercats, please?
Okay.
having such a wide audience, was there ever a point where it got so centralized on one, like one demo, and you were like maybe like nervous, like, oh shit, I'm just gonna have.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate it when I don't do well with just one demographic. Like, so if I get hired by like the Persian student group or the Saudi student group or like the liberal white group, whatever it is,
right?
I don't do that well because I like to go into the audience, be like, who's from here? Who's from there? Do we have any Mexicans? Yeah, do we have any? Sure. Do we have, like, sometimes you get people from places you've never, like, you don't know much about, and then you start talking to them, you know? You're like,
which is great about staying up in LA, don't you think? Because you're always, feel like, for the most part, getting a wide range of people.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fun. And I think it's like, I was talking, I was at the factory and I was doing crowd work and I was talking to this girl. There was this black girl from Africa. I forget. It was like, it was like Zimbabwe. I forget where it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was some country that I didn't know much about. So then I could have fun with it. I was like, so is this a Zimbabwean accent?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
she's like, no, you idiot. I'm like, okay, I'm trying.
Yeah, that's all I know. Yeah.
But that's all I know. I'm just gonna do lines from The Lion King and hopefully you think it's funny.
Well, like, it's fun. It's fun because we could play kind of the stupid idiot.
Yeah.
And, you know, because there's two ways to go about it. One is to be an asshole, which is just not my personality.
Yep. No, you're not. You're always friendly guy.
You know, and the other way is to just be the ignorant idiot. And I think
that's a great part to play, and I play that too. And I think that card is always keeps people on your side too, because then they're like, because I'd say a majority of the people have the same mindset you do about that moment.
Absolutely. So there's not that many people that know like
no one in the back's gonna yell out like, actually that's not how Zimbabweans talk, asshole. They don't know either. They're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're making conscious efforts to have a diverse audience in your stand up act. But like, I read your IMDb page, your credits are insane. You've been on so many TV shows. Is it hard? Does Hollywood try to pigeonhole you and say, like, you're the Middle Eastern guy?
Can you
play the Middle Eastern guy?
It's hard. It's Hollywood. I talk about it, but I also don't blame Hollywood that much, because I always say, first of all, people write what they know, right? So if I'm a white dude, I'm going to write the story that I know. Yeah. And so I need to cast an FBI agent. Well, he's going to be a blonde dude with glasses, and he's going to be buff and whatever, right?
Right.
Very rarely am I going to sit there and go, you know what? What if we made him a Middle Eastern dude that has, you know, because there's Middle Eastern FBI agents, there's Persian cops I've run into. Yeah. I played an Arab American Secret Service agent in the movie The Interpreter. So that was one of those that's one of those where I think that they probably were like, let's get a guy to be this, you know, and so whoever was doing it had this thought, and they might have. Right around then, there was actually an issue where there was an Arab American Secret Service agent who was getting on an airplane to go down to Texas to be on Bush's detail, and he had a gun getting on the plane.
Oh,
but they're allowed to, like, they're Secret Service agents.
They have the credentials.
Yeah, but the pilot wouldn't fly with him, so that became a whole big thing. Yeah, so
see, I didn't even hear about that story.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, so I think maybe that story might have inspired why that writer did. I'm guessing. I don't know why that writer might have read it and been like, oh, let's just put one in there.
Sure.
But definitely, I think for the most part, listen, when they have cab driver, falafel store owner, terrorist. They're going to think of me and people that look like me, right?
Right.
So I don't blame them, but I do love
it. So that's who's beating me out for the falafel store.
Maserati.
But I do get excited when they go, listen, we're bringing you in for just like this guy. You know?
Yeah, because you have a lot of roles that you've played that they could have given anybody.
Yeah, and listen, I've been on the other... Like, I made a movie a couple years ago now. Hopefully, it'll come out early next year. But it's called Jimmy Vestfoot, American Hero. But we had to cast as well, and I realized it's a hard process casting. Because you want to put all your friends in there, and then one friend's a little bit better than the other one, or maybe they got a look that the other one doesn't...
How much of it is look? Because we've talked about this in you know, moments, and you know, the amount of things I've gotten down to the last few and lost... are so many, and at that point it's not ability, because it's if you're the last few and you had to go through the ringer for a handful of things, and I've worked at a casting office for a little bit, so I know how much, but I've gotten away from really understanding how much that factors in. But
well, obviously that's a huge thing, but also it's like, it's not just your look, it's the look of the girl that you're supposed to be the husband to, and people going like, I don't believe that these two would be together.
I mean, 'cause and so many cooks in the kitchen, right?
And maybe someone's best friends with somebody. Yeah. I mean, that's why you got to just let it go. And that's why, and this is advice I give to everybody, but I need to take it myself, which is, I say, just create your own stuff. Just cast yourself. Yeah. Be the guy. You're going to cast yourself as a high-powered attorney who is whatever, going through a sex change. All right.
Yeah.
nobody would cast you as that.
Right.
But you're like, I'm going to do it. You know.
But Adam's like, you know what? I want to be the guy going through a sex change.
Absolutely.
And Adam, I applaud your decisions.
I'm very method.
No judgment on this side.
Hey man, the surgery wasn't that expensive. Brad actually cast me in his sex tape that he made, and I played a falafel store owner. So I hate to fucking rub it in your face, but that was
it all comes full circle.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts, shows you've ever been on, because Curb Your Enthusiasm is my favorite show.
Yeah, it's a great show.
And you was the hotel maintenance guy.
Yeah.
I mean, just the fucking best, dude.
Yeah, it was fun, man.
How was that whole...
That was interesting because I got the audition, and it's funny because my agent had told me it's for Saudi Sheikh. And I showed up and
Saudi
I looked.
Saudi Sheikh? Is that like the new dance we're supposed to know?
No, you know, the Sheikh, like a Sheikh.
Oh, Sheikh. Yeah, okay, Sheikh. Okay. Saudi Sheikh. Saudi Sheikh.
No, I meant like a Saudi Sheikh.
I was
going to
say, is it like a new beverage at McDonald's? Like
Saudi Sheikh.
What would that be, by the way?
A lot of sand. It's sand.
Wow. We'll be right back with more.
He did it too. See? He did it too.
It comes with blueberry. The Saudi Sheikh. So it was a Saudi Sheikh. And so I showed up and I look at the sign-in sheet and it says Indian Sikh, and I was like, my own agent got it wrong. I was like,
so
I was like, I was dressed for like, because I kind of showed up with like a suit and like a button, like buttoned up. I didn't have like the full gown, so then I was like, oh man. And then I go, well, I'll do Indian Sikh. So then I went in there, and it was great because you get to actually improv with Larry.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh shit.
Yeah, it was cool.
And so you knew it was Curb when you went in. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Usually they tell you what your audition.
Well, I don't know. You said the name of the role got mixed up, so I don't know.
No,
you knew.
But the show I knew.
Okay, good. Yeah.
It's like, wow, I thought I was going to be on Dora the Explorer, and all of a sudden I'm on Curb Your Enthusiasm. This is way different.
Wait a minute.
How's Larry?
It was great. So we went in there and just did some improv, and they were laughing, and it felt good, and you get it, and then it was such a cool experience because they just tell you. Like, they go, okay, in this scene, Larry has forgotten to tip you, and you're just upset about it.
That's really it.
And that's
it. I keep hearing about that, and I've heard that in so many interviews where it's just there's a rough outline.
Yeah.
They do it a bunch of different ways.
Yeah. It was great because I remember I did one take, and then I was like, I went up to Jeff Garland. I'm like, hey, man, I forgot what I did on that. What, can you remind me? He's like, just do something different. Doesn't matter. He's like, just do whatever you want. I was like, holy shit.
Because they got a handful of cameras going, so they're covering it from all angles, right?
Yeah, It was a real fun show to be on. Because, you know, as ultimately, when you're on a set or you're doing any kind of acting, you just want to be like, you want to be in the moment and as comfortable as possible. So if you have like crazy lines to learn, sometimes that takes you out of the moment because you're just sitting there trying to recite the lines.
Yeah, sure.
And you're not there emotionally. You're just like, you know, you're like...
You're not reacting to what the person across from you is saying.
No,
you're just thinking about what
90%
of
it. If you're listening out there and you're trying to be an actor, you got to fucking listen.
Yeah, you got to listen. And so that's why, like, whenever a writer or a director comes up and goes, "Listen, man, you've got the idea. You know, if you flub a couple lines, don't worry. Just keep going." Like that's where I think that's even in auditions. I think that's great to carry in where you go. If I mess up the lines a little bit. don't like kill myself.
Right. Just
because
keep going.
Just keep going. That's what they're looking for, the emotion, you know?
Well, right. And we've all experienced this, I'm sure, on stage as comedians, where we mess up a joke or we get something out of order or we do something that we wouldn't normally do.
Yeah.
And to us, we know that we messed up.
Yeah.
But the audience has no idea.
Exactly.
It was their first time seeing the show.
Yeah.
And it's almost always in our own heads. We're like, oh, man, we fucked up. The audience is like, no, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, so that's what's the beauty of a show like Curb, where there's no lines. Yeah. So it's like, you can't mess up a line.
Yeah.
You just got to keep listening to the guy. So
did your family see, what was the first thing your family, in support of, of your comedy career?
Yeah, they're definitely now. At first, my mom thought it was crazy because I come, coming from an immigrant background, especially like Iranians and I think like Indians and some of these other backgrounds, like they really want their kids to be lawyers and doctors and engineers, that kind of
that's
stuff.
That's no joke, huh? That's real.
That's serious.
And you were going well in the world of academia. Like you went to Berkeley?
Yeah, I went to Berkeley undergrad and then I was going to be a lawyer at that point and then I realized I didn't want to be a lawyer. So then I got into a PhD program at UCLA. I was going to get my PhD in political science to be a professor. And the first Professor J.
I can totally see that, by the way, because you got, I mean, I feel
by
like...
By the way, that's a sitcom.
Yeah.
Professor J?
I'm telling you,
come
man.
Come on,
the
man.
The title's there. Now give me the... Write the script.
I mean, the way you're... I'm sure you were already a natural good public speaker before stand-up, right?
Yeah.
You seem like you were.
Because I did plays. You were talking about musicals. Yeah. I did like musicals in junior high, and then I did plays. I was into it. I loved
it. What were you? Give me...
I did Little Abner. I was Little Abner.
Holy shit. Hey. Yeah, there's the videotape.
Yeah. I got it somewhere. I think Guys and Dolls. Is that Charleston? Mm-hmm. Won't you Charleston with me? So I did. That was the first one I did in seventh grade. Then in eighth grade, I got the part of Little Abner. And then after that, we had a great theater program, and they would like write original stuff, and we would.
This
do
is
it.
In Iran.
No,
Northern California.
Oh, okay.
Because you moved when you were six.
But although
I would love to see Guys and Dolls, but only an all radio cast. That'd be fantastic. Please tell me there's a Hello Dolly
over there, right?
Huh? They love. It's kind of like Iranian cinema is huge. Like Iranian cinema always is like world renowned and like winning all kinds.
Who's
of
Who's the
awards.
Meryl Streep of Iranian cinema right now?
Oh, I mean, in America, there's a lady named Shohreh Aghdashloo. Easy for me to say.
Sure.
She was the lady from House of Sand and Fog. She was on 24. She's that lady with the very thick accent.
Yeah,
deep. So she's like now out here that she would be that. But in Iran, there's a lot of great actors. There was a movie called A Separation, which won the best foreign picture. I think 2 years ago. It's called A Separation. It is one of the most amazing. The same year, The Descendants, that was the one with George Clooney.
Yeah, right, in Hawaii. Yeah.
Won Best Picture. That won Best Foreign. And I saw both, and I thought Descendants was great. But if you watch Separation, whole other level. I was like, wow. Separation should have been nominated for like Best Film.
Oh, man.
Intense. You can watch it with subtitles. It is crazy. And what I love about that, going back to what you're talking about, like Hollywood and stuff and like typecasting, that was a movie. There's a director. His name is Asghar Farhadi. He's like, he wins all
If you're
awards.
Playing at home, drink five.
Reference. Yeah. He wins awards all the time. And this guy just wrote a story about a guy struggling with his life. So it was a guy who, I believe, was either going through divorce that's why it's called The Separation. He's going through separation with his wife. They've got a young daughter. He hires a caretaker because he's got his father is like old and dying. And you watch this movie, and it takes you in emotionally, and it has nothing to do with terrorists or cab drivers or falafel, none of that stuff. It's a real story, and that's why? Because it's an Iranian writing a story.
Right.
So that's why I'm saying, like, I don't blame Hollywood, because this is
they
a story.
Write
this
you
guy,
know.
Yeah, you write what you know. And this guy was writing a story of what he knew, and it was amazing. So, so I think there's a rich culture of acting in Iran, but it's still in like the more, let's say, middle to middle upper class, they probably are still kind of a little snooty about it. Yeah, like if you wanted to do it as a career, you know, once you've made it, they love you.
Okay. So is this how your family approached it as well?
Yeah, I think my family was like, you're crazy. So first I told them, I said, okay, I'll be a lawyer because of them. They said, you should be a lawyer. I said, okay. And then I said, I'm going to be a professor. And already my mom was freaking out because she was like, you're not going to make, what kind of money can you make as a professor? Da, 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 da.
Now in your head, are you also thinking like, all right, if I'm a professor, at least I'm in front of people and I can still maybe...
It was the compromise. It was the compromise of like a job that is reputable, But also, I get to be in front of people, and also I get to talk about ideas that are really interesting to me.
The comedy wasn't an option. Like, comedy, this wasn't in your head. Stand-up wasn't even.
No, because I was a huge stand-up fan. I'd wanted to do stand-up when I was 17. I was in a theater program all through high school, so I wanted to do stand-up at 17 because I was a big fan of Eddie Murphy's. And I tried it, and I tried writing it, and I would write it.
Oh, my God.
And it was funny because when I would write it, I was like, oh, this is amazing. And then the next day, I would read it, I'd be like, this is horrible. And so it was for this like talent show that was coming up, and basically I chickened out. Like, the material was all sexual material. Like, I was like, why is our genitalia in the most uncomfortable place of our body? Why isn't it on our palms? We can just go around having sex, high fiving people, right? Right.
It's a good joke.
Right. By the way, I love, because every comic has an early chunk of sex material.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, like, that's such a great. Somebody should make a book of like famous comedians, because it's like, it's like your first like opinion on something that you kind of know but don't really, because you're first and you're dabbling in sexual.
Especially if you watch Eddie Murphy, you're like, okay, well, that's what works.
I do. Of course. Right. And also, you're 17, so that's like, that's what you're passionate about. Like, also, right, you know?
Aside from the joke, you're making a great point. Why do we not have dick hands?
Yeah, exactly. Dick hands.
Hey, God, you fucked up, man.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
Well, I think that they should make that Iranian movie.
Yeah, dick hands.
The dick hands.
Well, you know, they have like the Hulk gloves at Universal Studios. Why don't you just
get? Have dick hands.
Yeah, yeah. But the girls, would they also have to have then
vagina hands.
Or vagina fists?
Yeah, vagina fists. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
God, you like. If you ever got a round of applause,
just do a threesome. Just be
high five and
banging two chicks at the same time with two hands.
Imagine those like the high fives after sporting games when you're saying like good game.
Oh, yeah.
Like those co-ed games would be a fucking giant gangbang celebration.
Awesome. So
all right. So you start
so then my folks would do this, and then I said, professor, and she said, you're crazy, but then I went down that path. And then right away I realized I didn't want to do that. Then I dropped out of grad school, and that's when my mom like was really worried, and she was like, okay, listen, at least become a mechanic. And I was like, what? Yeah, exactly. I go, how'd you go
lawyer,
from
lawyer, professor?
Lawyer to mechanic. And her worry was, because we came from a revolution. She, if you think about it, you know, when she was in her whatever it was, mid-30s to late 30s, we had a revolution. She had to leave her country, and like our whole lives turned upside down. Mm-hmm. So in her mind, I think that she was still traumatized by it and thought, you need to have a job that you can do in other countries. And so her point was, she goes, listen, people need mechanics. No one needs an actor. And I was like, you know what? That's a good point.
Wow.
That's very wise.
No one needs an actor.
I mean, it's well thought out. So in her mind, it's like, well, if you got to pick up everything and then ditch this country because another revolution happens and you go to Canada or you go to wherever, they're going to need a mechanic in Canada.
Yeah,
so.
You're not going to get an acting gig in Argentina, but you can fix the shit out of a Benz, you know?
Wow. I mean, and when she told you that, did you say, okay, I'll try to be a mechanic?
No, I was like, you're crazy. And I realized this is what I wanted to do. But then what I had was, I got a day job at an ad agency. And again, that was another one of these compromises in my mind where I was like, okay, you know what? I'll get an office job. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to work my way to becoming a copywriter. And then eventually I can become a freelance copywriter. And then that will allow me to make pretty good money for half the year, and then go out and audition the other half of the year.
And you're still creating.
Yeah, and you're still creating and all that. Yeah. And so it wasn't. So it was till I was like 26 I was doing that. And then at 26 I finally had a light bulb moment. I was talking to this guy. His name is Joe Ryan. He's passed away since, but he was at the ad agency. He was older. And I told him my plans, and I was like, listen, when I'm 30, I'm really going to go for this acting thing. And he's like, let me talk to you. He goes, listen, when I was in my 20s, there were some things I wanted to do. And he goes, I never got around to doing it. So he goes, if you really want to do it, do it. And I was like, wow, you're right. And it was a light bulb moment. So then I decided to just re-enroll in improv classes. And from there, I got into a stand-up comedy class. And then that was 17 years ago. I've been going since.
Holy shit. God, what a pivotal moment. So, I mean,
was there a moment when your family was like, okay, now we accept this?
Yeah, I think my mom, once she started coming around and seeing the success and seeing people laugh, I think she started going like, oh, okay, she started getting it. And then she became like a supporter and a fan. Like now when I have, like, she'll come over once in a while and be like, hey, I need two or three books for my friends. Like, she's just like, she's taking my merchandise.
Oh, she's getting your books. So cool.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then you know that because then you know that when your family does that, that they're proud of you, that they're getting, it's like, no, look, my son's a comedian, like, and they're proud of that fact.
Yeah, and it's interesting now. It's like I've often said, it's interesting to me too, because it's like in the Persian community and in some communities, like, people know me, and in some communities, people have no idea who I am.
Right.
So I kind of consider it like, I wanted to do a show called My Two Worlds, and this mm-hmm. happened one time where I was like on Beverly Drive in Beverly Hills, and I was walking down the street, and there was these kids from Beverly Hills High School, and there was like 5 Persians and 1 Asian kid, and mm-hmm. they all knew me, and they started freaking out. They're like, "Oh my God, Majorani, what's up? Picture." We took pictures, mm-hmm. and then I crossed the street, and it was a bunch of like white people that had no idea who I was.
Yeah,
and I was like, "It's so funny, like my world's like that." And so whenever my mom's around, like if I'm recognized by somebody or something, I think like that makes that reinstates the thing of like, oh, he's doing well,
he's
and
doing
all
okay.
that. You know?
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Isn't it crazy, man?
How did, when you first started doing the road and like just getting in, integrated into the LA comedy scene, were there people that you, I don't know, like a class of dudes that you met and bonded with to really like also, because I feel like having a support system, I feel like in stand-up
absolutely.
Is crucial.
Yeah, when we first started out, like my crew was like, it was like Sam Tripoli, yeah. Brett Ernst, Sebastian.
All great.
Bobby
comics.
Lee in there?
Yeah. Bobby Lee was a little bit older than us, but he was probably part of that. I mean, he'd already been doing it for a little bit.
Yeah.
Me and Sebastian became regulars at the Comedy Store around the same time. And then I'd been friends with Tripoli, and I'd been trying to get him in. Mm-hmm. And when we did first Arabian Nights, they were looking for comedians, and I'd seen Aaron Cater one time. I didn't know him yet,
yeah.
but I knew he was half Palestinian. So I got a call from Rusty Dooley, who used to book the Comedy Store.
Yeah,
and he's
Rusty.
Like, listen, and Rusty's a great guy. So he's like, listen, Mitzi's trying to put this show together. She's looking for comedians that are either Arabs or whatever, Middle Eastern, Iranians, whatever. And she goes, you know any? I go, well, there's this guy, Aaron Cater. He's half Palestinian. So I think I probably helped get him into the club. Mm-hmm. Then I called up Tripoli. I go, listen, your last name is Tripoli, and that's the capital of Libya. I go, are you Arab by any chance? And he's like, no, but I'm like, my mom's Armenian. I go, I think that might work.
Yeah.
And Duncan knew
like,
Tripoli.
It's like white people don't know the difference. It's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And Duncan knew Tripoli. So I go, Duncan, what about this? And he's like, that's a great idea. So then we got Tripoli in because Tripoli had been auditioning for her and she hadn't been passing him.
Yeah.
So because he had that background, he got mm-hmm. in. And then,
which, if you've seen Sam's comedy,
has nothing to do with it.
Nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
He does not go on stage and talk about it at all.
Yeah. And then Brett Ernst. So then one night we were doing a big show in the main room and Mitzi was there watching.
Yeah.
And I wanted her to see Brett, and it was impossible to get her to watch. Mm-hmm. So somebody came over and goes, Maz, Mitzi wants you on next. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I go, listen, do me a favor, tell them you couldn't find me and put Brett up instead. So Brett got up in front of her, killed it.
Yeah.
She loved him and then made him a regular.
Wow.
So that's how all those guys.
No kidding.
Yeah, man.
It's so cool that you had. Like that you were instrumental in those guys coming up. But I mean, I feel like too many times comics turn this whole business into a competition. And it's just like, well, he's getting this and I'm not getting this.
And it is to a certain extent.
Yeah, but first of all, listen, those were my buddies.
Yeah.
And it was like, and they were good enough that they were going to get in at some point, but it was just a matter of the hustle they had to keep doing. And it was like, let's just try and make it happen. And secondly, the way I see it is, listen, if you make it and we're buddies, like hopefully you're going to find a place for me. Like that was what I loved about Whitney. I remember being, they got me to do a guest star on Whitney playing a doctor mm-hmm. and I was at the table read for it. And so I'm playing the doctor.
And then your parents are like, finally a doctor.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm playing the doctor. There's Whitney. There's obviously D'Elia.
Yeah.
And then that episode.
By the way, there's obviously D'Elia is definitely a show we should pitch to.
Definitely, right?
Maybe, I don't know, the girls he's been with. Maybe it's a TLC show where we just interview all of them.
Obviously D'Elia. That's funny.
Who have you slept with? Well, it's obviously D'Elia. Yeah.
And then, but that episode was written by, I'm sorry, Tone Bell was on there as
nice.
Well.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? He was
former
on he was,
the
yeah, he was,
that podcast.
He, yeah. Right. And then that episode was written by Owen Smith. So I was like, this is
nice.
Like a Comedy Store reunion.
Yeah.
And it felt so right. And I told Whitney, I said, this is awesome that you're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So you hope that people continue to do things like that, you know? And you're right. Some people have, listen, end of the day, we all have a lot of issues. And that comes from your childhood.
Sure.
And some people don't deal with it, and then they end up doing well in this business, and they don't know how to deal with other people and be good to other people. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame, because as much as you might sit there and go, God, that guy's an asshole. No, you know what? That guy's miserable, and it's unfortunate, because he'll never be happy. No matter how much fame or fortune or success he gets, he won't realize that it's not about pulling up in your Lamborghini, but it's about like surrounding yourself with your buddies and giving them, you know, pitch, you know, pass, assisting once in a while.
Sure.
Yeah, man.
You know?
Yeah.
You've done such a great job of that with openers too, with Amir K and Kayvon.
Kayvon, the black guy, Kayvon.
I mean, if you take out the dash, it's Kayvon.
Yeah.
But it's Kayvon.
Kayvon.
Yeah. Where did, and I just want to get into before we totally wrap this up, but Amir, I've gone on the road with, we did a handful of co-headlining things, and some of the craziest stories I've ever had have been with Amir.
Yeah.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, that... Amir is like, I tell him, he's one of the most talented guys that I know. He's hilarious, he's talented.
Just the joke telling and the voices and the sound effects.
Yeah, it's like I keep telling him, like, you should be on Saturday Night Live. Like,
I know, man. Yeah, he's an incredible because he's also a great actor, and it's like his when he goes into a different character or a voice, or he's they're grounded. Like, you always buy you're watching that person because he kind of embodies them.
Yeah,
and you can tell he's just a good mimic. He picks up on the things of a character or a person to emulate that is
he's very good, and it's just a matter of time. And I've always told him, I've said, like, listen, you got the talent. Now you just got to focus. Because some people are really good on the business side. They're not as good with the talent side. Some people are great at the talent, not as good with the business.
And again, no real training for that other than just doing it and figuring it out as you go, right?
Just doing it. And I think he's made some progress on the business side as well. But it's just a matter of like getting it. Like, you know how it is. Like, nobody's got an attention span anymore. So you could be like, look, listen, this guy's talented. He's this, that, and the other. Yeah. And unless you get like a 1 minute clip that like boom, 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 it just kills. Right. Or pick something up on, like, you know, people start passing around on YouTube or something. People aren't going to listen because there's so much stuff they're bombarded with. So I think it's a matter of time for him. But it was great. So it was fun to have him on the road. And he would go dirtier than I would want him to. But it was fine because it also challenged me to kind of be able to bring the crowd back in terms of, like, back to my voice. And I like having strong openers because
I was going to ask about that. Yeah,
yeah, because you know I think that it challenges me to, you know, work harder, and also I think that they get a full show.
I was going to say it makes your show better.
Makes your show better.
Walk out loving the, you know, it came for you, but like
and they walk out going, wow, that was good from start to finish. I mean, no, if you have two lame openers, then you just dug yourself a bigger hole as a headliner to try to get out of.
They enjoy your... It can go both ways, because if the guy's horrible, then you go up and they're like, oh, thank God. But overall, though, I agree. I think that you want to have a great show. And like I want to... Like, my whole goal with both of those guys as we kept going was like hoping that anyone in my fan base that like them would start to follow them as well, to the point where then they can just go on and headline, you know, because that's what they need to do ultimately, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think it's happening. I think it's happening for both of them. And again, it's just a matter of time.
Any crazy stories with Amir?
that you're allowed to tell?
Yeah. Well, you guys haven't gone everywhere. And I mean, you're on the road. I mean, there's probably no club you haven't played. Yeah.
Yeah, we played a lot. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite city or a place?
My favorite places are like Stockholm, DC, San Francisco. Those are all great places. Amir, I mean, it's like constant. Like, it's funny because I've always felt like the older brother to him.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had like all kinds of, like, there's like almost getting in a fight in West Nyack with this guy who was a bouncer for no reason. Like, because Amir wears that hat of his.
Yeah.
And the guy was like, all right, you know, this guy wasn't even a bouncer. He was like helping the bouncer.
Oh,
and the guy's like, you got to take your hat off.
Bitch.
Yeah. But he's kind of a big dude. And like, he was like, and he's like, you got to take your hat off. And Amir kind of was talking back to him. And then the guy says something else. And then we're like, you know what? We're out of here. And we start walking away. And this guy starts running down the street wanting to fight with Amir. And I'm like, holy shit, there's a big black dude charging us. And I'm like trying to step between them. And Amir's kind of like thinking about getting into it. Like he was like pumped up to him. It was me, him, and someone else. And we basically like, we calmed it down. And it's funny because Amir's referenced that since, because I told him, I said, listen, dude, I go, that guy has been waiting all week to have Friday night to come and find a fight.
Fight
like,
night. Yeah.
He's got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Right. I go, you've got like, you're trying to get a life. Like you got, yeah, a, you career. Got a career. You got, yeah, a life. Like why would you engage in that?
This is a great story for him that people expect and will be pumped to hear. Like, yeah, this for you is like, yeah, the for end you, of a lot of shit.
Yeah. It's like, don't get yourself into that situation. So we, you know, we've had stuff like that. And, mm-hmm, and,
have you yourself been in fights?
I'm not. I don't get into too many fights. I'm pretty mellow. Like, I try to avoid them. I think
every time I've seen you, you're always smiling and happy.
Yeah, you're a nice guy. I mean, I got nothing to fight about. I've actually. Yeah. It's funny because I broke up a fight there, and then one time I was with Kayvon when he was touring with me. We were at like at a club after one of the shows, and it was weird because I think because Kayvon's a good looking guy, and I think that there must have been a girl that was kind of like giving him the eye or something, and I think the girl might have been there with a guy, and then the guy got pissed and was kind of like staring Kayvon down, and I'm sure. like, and Kayvon's not a fighter either,
no.
and I had to like get in the
well,
middle.
Well, he's not, but Kayvon is. His
Kayvon is, yeah, yeah.
It's like Steve Urkel and Stefan Urkel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I read. I'm going to ask you one more thing, and that's I just have to know if this is true, because in looking up before this podcast, I read on your. On your Wikipedia page, it literally says that your nickname is the Persian Pink Panther.
Dude, oh, that is the funniest thing. So this is what happens. So
it just sounds like a sex move to me. Oh, like, yeah. Hey, did you hear the Persian Pink Panther last night? Dude. You know I did.
What would that be?
I have no idea.
This is the most ridiculous thing. So last year when I was doing Montreal,
yeah.
I kept going to these interviews, and they kept saying like, all right, here with us today, the Persian Pink Panther. And I was
they
like,
"They play the theme song."
Yeah, no. And I go. So finally, after the second or third one, I go, "Where'd you get this?" And the guy's like, "It's on your Wikipedia page." I go, "What?" So I look it up. This is what happened. The movie I was telling you about, Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero. Yeah. The way I describe it, I go, "It's like the Persian Pink Panther meets Borat."
Gotcha.
So I kept describing it like that, and somehow someone went on Wikipedia, put it on there. And I've tried to get it off. Wikipedia won't listen to me. Like, they don't trust me.
Hey, we know Maz Gibrani a little better than you do,
now. Yeah, sorry, Maz. We know the real Maz.
Dude, it's the weirdest thing. I'm like, listen, this is me. Take that stupid thing off there. And now it's become this thing where wherever I go, people go, he's also known as a Persian Pink Panther.
Oh, my God. Wait, so it really has infiltrated the rest of your, I mean.
Because whoever Wikipedia's me says Maz Gibrani, also known as the Persian Pink Panther.
All right, so have you written a bit about this?
I've not written a bit about it. I should write a bit about it.
I bet you have to because, and because just to play into it a little bit, because if people are coming to the show being like, we're going to see the Persian Pink Panther, people are like, what the fuck is that? Maz Gibrani. They're like, oh, I know who that is. Who's the Persian Pink Panther? Yeah. Well, that's But then if you talk about it, maybe then the people coming to expect it.
Strip club in Egypt.
Yeah. There should be something. Actually, that's funny because there is something about like criticizing Wikipedia on that.
That's hilarious.
Not knowing how to crack Wikipedia.
Right.
Yeah.
And I just love the fact that it's literally you calling them up saying, hey, I'm not the Persian Pink Panther. They're no.
I went on. I started like I got a little account going.
That's
whatever.
The beginning of the robot revolution, by the way. They're like, oh, no, we know who you are.
We know who you are.
And we're going to keep that info locked up.
Yeah.
And if you want, you can't change who you I feel like you got, because you could capitalize on a lot of Persian Pink Panther dolls.
Yeah,
Persian
of course.
Pink Panther.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie, the Persian Pink Panther. I mean, Jesus Christ. It's like the ladies' man meets.
I don't know. Borat? Yeah. I don't
meets,
know.
Meets Dirk
like,
Diggler.
It's like identity theft, but it's like you've stolen an identity that you didn't want to steal, but now it's been given to you.
Well, Maz, it's always been my dream to talk to the Persian Pink Panther.
Yeah, and here's the opening scene. The Persian Pink Panther is a rock star, okay?
Uh-huh.
He's a rock star in Egypt, and his voice, he loses his voice. And so he goes to like the like really, you know, depths, the really nasty streets of Egypt, and he finds the dirtiest bum he can.
Oh God, we're going full circle.
There you go.
Yeah. Gets a little bit of that juice.
Juice.
Coats the throat.
Comes back as the Persian Pink Panther.
There it is. All right. It's you're not receptive, but we'll work it out in the writing room.
Maz, thank you so much for
coming
on.
Thanks for having me,
man.
Guys.
So that's the show. Danza.
Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamy Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, Schlesinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.